Okay. So I'm going to be talking about basically simulations of black holes, but I'm going to be doing a more general talk because I think a lot of people in the audience don't actually are not experts in this. I might bore the experts for a little while. And I might repeat a few things that Lewis and even John mentioned. But the focus of the talk is actually what we have done in the past and what we want to do in the future and how to do it for studying binary black holes. So I decided to start with just a little bit of the history of this problem, and it goes way back 40 years. It's really amazing that the first two-body problem of the collision of two black holes, we would call it today, but in that age it wasn't called like that, was done in 1964 by Hahn and Lindquist. They didn't talk about black holes, of course. I don't even know if Wheeler had already invented the name by then, probably not, right? They were already using many of the things we use today. They were using initial data was a non-trivial topology of a wormhole type, which is what we do today, but with a kind of topology we don't use anymore. It was just a handle connecting to these different regions of the same universe. Now we tend to connect one universe to other separate universes. But it didn't use the ADM equations, because of course the ADM equations were also not quite there yet. So it was using a forced stop of symbols of fundamental variables, and it was using what today we would call eudesic slicing, which is essentially following freely falling observers. So of course, in model terms, it was doomed, because if you follow a freely falling observer, it's going to hit the singularity pretty quickly. But that's what they find, and that was a pioneering work. I think very, very interesting work. But it took about 10 years, at least, before it was attempted again. But now we're much better understanding what was happening. Now we're talking about black holes. We have much better understanding of the initial data when SmartNetLab did this. Much better understanding of slicing conditions, which allowed this problem to be solved much better then, because we could really slow the evolution and not hit the singularity and do some interesting physics. They extracted the amount of radiation, some estimates of that, so it was a really interesting work. And then very recently, about 10 years ago, and look at the timescales, this was redone. The SmartNetLab results were essentially revisited by the then NCSA group, and just using much better computers, some improved understanding of many things, gravitational wave extraction, nice movies came out of that. But it was the same problem. So I guess that this would show that it took a while, but now we believe that the head-on collision of two black holes, which is the simplest two-body problem I can think in GR, we would consider it essentially solved. Doesn't mean we can do it for arbitrarily large separations, no. There's still some caveats, but we think we understand the basic properties of the system. On the other hand, if you want something more complicated, I call this looking for the holy grail, because the holy grail in this area of binary black holes is to do, of course, the in-spiral coalescence of two black holes. That's what we would like to do. And that requires going to 3D, and there's been a very difficult road in the last 10 years. It inspired the Binary Black Hole Alliance, the grand challenge that went on for 4 years from the 90s, and I think the best thing, I mean, the most important thing we learned from that thing is that the problem was far more difficult than anybody thought. Initially, I think people just thought, we know the equations, the ADM equations, we know how to code, well, we know Fortran or C, so we can write computer codes. We have big enough computers, so this is just a brute force approach, we'll just code them up and it'll work. And of course it didn't. So that's what we learned. It's a difficult problem, and come back to that in a minute. And then things have been developing slowly ever since. So by 1997, Bernd Brookman did the first proof of principle grazing collision, where the black holes don't hit each other head on but have a glancing blow. And this is a 3D calculation for the first time, as well. It's a very short-lived simulation, still using the AEM system of equations, but it was also the first one to try it. Then, roughly simultaneously, the Penn State Austin collaboration and the Potsdam groups did again grazing collisions a couple of years later in 2000, basically, with very different approaches. In one case, it was moving black holes and excision, and the other cases, there was no excision, and there was a new formulation of the equations, which Lewis mentioned, and I'm going to come back to it in a moment. But basically, the same problem was attacked. Then we reached what we're calling what John called the ISCOS and pre-ISCOS simulations, which is really, we think, some approximation to orbital configurations of black holes. Of course, this is all approximate. And this was attempted in Potsdam about 2 years ago for the first time, from two different perspectives. The Lazarus perspective, which you've heard from John, which was short-lived, short nonlinear evolutions in ADM, plus a perturbative evolution at the end. And they have this very nice wave from Sethank. And of course, the fully nonlinear approach, also in Potsdam, in which you just want to make this system without any approximations last as long as you want. And the rationale is not so much, I mean, they can solve the problem, why bother, right? But the rationale is eventually, when you put the black holes further and further apart, you're going to need longer lived full numerical simulations. So you better learn how to do it. So this approach has also been done in PuTTM. With improved gauge conditions, again, new formulations. Co-rotation shifts, I'm going to come to that in a minute again. And with different techniques like excision, which I'm going to mention again in a moment. And then very recently, in the last year or so, a couple of years, things have been happening in different areas. So we've been gaining more understanding of live gauge conditions, laps and shift, different ones. We're comparing different initial data. The PuTTM group has been using different initial data to do runs, and that's very interesting as well. There's improved excision techniques that have allowed the Penn State group to move black holes and have black holes rotate artificially by a choice of gauge, have black holes move around the grid. There's a very important improvement of the standard of hyperbolic formulations and what you need to have a hyperbolic formulation and well potentness, things like that have been. This work has been done by the Caltech-Cornell groups and also by the Louisiana group lately, which has shown us a lot of things that we didn't know about boundaries and also very strict formal numerics and hyperbolicity. And just wanted to mention that there's recently also this 3D event horizon finder code that Peter Wiener has developed, which is, we can also now start to use to answer this question. So when we talk about binary black holes, is there really just one black hole or are there two from the beginning? Because if there's really only one, then we didn't do a binary black hole even though we thought we did. I'm going to go now to just what I call the recipe for successful binary black hole simulation. And this is all the ingredients I think we need at this point, and we've learned that we need to do this. So the first ingredient is, of course, just get your raw material, get some initial data, and there's a lot of work in that area. So I'm going to come back in a minute to that, but not much because Greg Cook's going to talk about initial data. But basically, if you can have some astrophysically motivated initial data, that's good. Otherwise, just get something and evolve it and see what we can do. But then once you've got the initial data, you've got to choose your evolution system of equations, which is a very hot topic today. You would like to use a well-posed system of evolution equations, which we think now that it's a necessary ingredient, but not necessarily sufficient, as we've learned. But the problem now is we probably have an embarrassment of riches. We have now lots of formulations, some of them with dozens of parameters. So we're really in a position where we have a lot of very nice formulations, but we don't have a clue how to choose the good one or the best one. And that's very, very difficult problem at this time. Then we need the slicing condition and the shift conditions, and choose your coordinates well. And there's a lot of choices again. So there's a lot of different versions of Laplace conditions, elliptic, so I'm going to come back into this in a minute, but there's really a lot of choices we can make in this area. We're beginning to learn a bit about this as well, and what sort of things we can ask for the Laplace condition that might be useful in guiding us in this choice. The shift condition is a bit worse. Basically, there's a lot less experience with shift conditions. Most people in the past, and myself included, have just done simulations with zero shift because that's the easy thing to do, right? But we've learned that really if you want to study a binary black hole, zero shift is not going to cut it. And the reason is pretty obvious, because if you have two black holes going around, you're going to have dragging of inertial frames, a lot of shear in the metric. If you don't compensate for that with the shift vector, you're going to die very quickly. So that's an important problem. Then boundary conditions. So again, we haven't worried enough about boundary conditions lately, in most of the time. But people now, like Jeff Winokur and the Louisiana group as well, and Bella Zelaghi, are really worrying about boundary conditions, and we should really do consistent boundary conditions, make sure we don't introduce constraint violations, make sure that our system is still well-posed once we put boundary conditions. That's also a very complicated problem. So there's all these issues to worry about. But there's extra issues that once you've solved all those problems, assuming you have, that you still have to choose. I call this the extra topics, because you can do it one way or another, and it's pretty much up to your taste. You want to excise or you don't want to excise. And people tend to believe excision is necessary. I'm going to argue in a minute that it's not quite necessary, and it's still a choice you have to make. You want to move the black holes or you don't want to move the black holes? And again, you say, well, if I have binary black holes, they're moving, right? Not necessarily. If I choose a coordinate system that co-rotates with the black holes, I can essentially glue the black holes to the grid and take all the dynamics into the metric. And that's a totally separate approach. So there's different choices. For example, the Potsdam approach has been always to keep the black holes glued to the grid. The Penn State approach has been to move the black holes around. So there's different choices to make. Co-rotation has been also becoming a nice thing that you can add, because if you have a co-rotating shift, you reduce the dynamics of the system a lot. And you essentially have a very slow adiabatic motion of the binary instead of a very big motion of black holes going around the grid. Finally, this ingredient that I dream about every day and I've been waiting for years, and now I'm glad to hear that maybe Joan's group has already had something that works, AMR. And everybody would say, please. But the typical answer to this thing is, we don't have it. And there's many reasons why we don't have it. We've been waiting for AMR for years, but then if you don't have AMR, maybe what we call box-in-box or fixed refinement, that will do, some a series of boxes with higher and higher resolution inside, and you don't adapt it. There's, again, some codes that sort of can do that, but it's still in the works. We don't have examples in which that works for a long time. And then there's this idea that that we just had for John Baker Fisheye, in which it was, well, you accept that we don't have these codes at the moment, so just we're relativists after all, so we can always change the coordinates. So we use coordinates that have high resolution inside and low resolution outside, and that's usually called fisheye coordinates. And that's the way many simulations have been done in the last couple of years or so, particularly all the Lazarus runs have been done using that idea, which is a sort of version of AMR when you don't have real AMR. Finally, if you've done all that, you need to write your code, which is hard part. Let's assume that that's easy. We just get a graduate student or a postdoc to sit there for a couple of years, and we'll end up with a code. Right? Don't know if it worked. And once you've got the code, you have to run it. Right? And we're getting to the point where we're trying to run these things in teraflop terabyte computers, and we don't have many of those around, so that's also an important issue. So I'm going to go back to some of these points. Sorry? Yeah, I forgot visualization. But I'm going to show some visualizations, which after all, that's it. I'm not going to talk much about initial data. The thing I want to mention only about initial data is there's many different types of initial data for binary black holes, and many different flavors and many different approximations. Well, not approximations, ansatz. So with many different ansatz you have to use to build this circular orbit. It's not clear which one of them is better. And I think all of this involve a number of unknowns. You don't, for example, you have no control over the amount of spurious gravitational radiation you add into your initial data. So it's going to be there. And the nice answer would be initially, well, there's gravitational waves there that I don't want, but if I just follow the motion of black holes for a couple of orbits, that junk's going to go away, and then I don't have to worry. But of course, we cannot follow a couple of orbits. So then that's a very important issue. And there's a lot of very interesting work. And there's also, very recently, there's been work in trying to get initial data motivated from post-Newtonian approximation, which probably is the way to go. But it's very early to say. But I'm sure that Greg's going to...
How do they push it under the constraint?
That's a good question. I think you would have to ask them. I'm not an expert in...
The best thing to do is just to take one of those really good, and I've seen some really good post-Newtonian descriptions of this problem, and just take them as the given data, and use the conformal factor and and push them onto the constraint surface. Now, it's not guaranteed that that's the same push that Einstein would like.
Exactly.
God, but it will work. Yeah. And from that, I think the best initial data will come.
I think I agree with that. Yeah, I agree totally with that.
You would do that, wouldn't you, Greg?
No, I'm saying that's exactly what they do.
Oh, well, that's the thing.
But if you look at this way, this is all we have done. So it's going to be pushing in an arbitrary direction, and then have to worry about what we want. So that's a very important thing.
You have
done it?
You've
done it now. Right, all we do is solve your constraints.
Yeah.
But then you have to be skilled ahead beyond that to analyze the properties.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm going to mention about the initial data. The other very hot topic lately, and really you should, this produce a lot of literature, is the formulation of the equations that we're using. For a long time we didn't have a lot of choices, so there's all the old pre-ADM formulations that we use, the formulation of Madame Choquet-Bruhal 52, and then several others, so there's many there. Where they were using not even a 3+1 split, but actually the 10 components of the metric as basic variables and very specific gate choices. Then, of course, we have the ADM formulation, which is the one that was used formally in numerical relativity for a long time, with the exception that what we call ADM in numerical relativity is not that formulation, but the one you would find in Jim's paper of 79, which is somewhat different because there's the Hamiltonian constraint is added in a different way. But that's what we normally call ADM in numerical relativity. And then in the last decade or so, there was two different approaches to changing these equations, and the reason was these equations were seemed to be very unstable. Nobody knew why the equations were unstable, particularly in three-dimensional evolutions. So there were two different directions for looking for different equations. So one was the more mathematical approach, in which people were looking for hyperbolic formulations for the reasons that Lewis was mentioning. If you have a strongly or symmetric hyperbolic formulation, you can then at least prove well-posedness at a mathematical level and hope that that will improve your numerical simulations. So there was a series, and this is by no means an exhaustive list, as many other people working on in this area, but this was a series of attempts, or not attempts, but of works trying to build hyperbolic formulations, successful in many ways. So you have many different hyperbolic formulations that came up during those decades. And I say the last one of those is the one called now KST, for Kidder-Shield-Tarkovsky. Not the last one, but one of the last ones, in which this finally they generalized this so much that you end up with a large number of parameters for building hyperbolic formulations.
I understand the idea of what we call isotropy is slightly different from previous.
Oh, okay.
I mean, this is a teeny point. The other teeny point is Einstein-Christoffel simple was just systems just made as an example of this process that's gone bananas with my friends.
Exactly.
Did you mean you started? Yeah.
It's actually gotten worse, because now when I get here, the last formulation of Lee and Mark has 35 parameters or something like that. So it's nasty. Life gauges, I'm coming to that in a minute. But essentially, many of these formulations, not all of them, but many of these formulations were shown to be hyperbolic when you used the prescribed densitized laps. So you not the laps itself, but you densitized the laps, and you said this densitized laps is either a known function of space-time, or you know its evolution by some source gaze functions. Exactly. So that's in that sense, they're not live gauges, because the gauge is chosen a priori. Now, the other road that was taken essentially during the same time was, I think, started by the Japanese group, was just saying, well, let's just rewrite the equations in different ways and see if it's more stable. And that developed over the years, still in the Japanese group. In 98, I think something crucial happened when Thomas Baumgartner and Stu Shapiro essentially just rewrote a little bit this formulation of Shibata Nakamura. But what they did was compared it systematically with ADM for a series of test cases. And they showed there that it was systematically much more stable, which I think is something that people hadn't realized before, that you could really have seriously improved the stability of your evolutions by just changing them. I think people hadn't really noticed that before. Because what had happened here is some of these things that had been tried, for example, the Bonamassa system had been coded, and it didn't show any improvement in stability over ADM. So there was a feeling that you're not gaining much. But here it was shown that really you gained a lot of instability. So this system has evolved to what's called BSSN for Baumgartner, Shapiro, Shibata, and Nakamura. It's been used a lot lately by groups working in 3D numerical relativity. The way it's written normally, it's not clear if it's hyperbolic or not. But then the Louisiana group also showed that you can find hyperbolic versions of this and even symmetric hyperbolic versions of BSSN. So that sort of closes the thing, because now we're getting also to hyperbolicity here. And finally, now we're getting examples of hyperbolic systems in which you have you allow the laps, even the densitized laps, to evolve in response to the dynamics of the space-time and not to be prescribed.
What's the evolution room?
The evolution room, well, you have, for example, generalizations of the laps that Bonn and Massa used. That gives you an evolution equation for the densitized laps that has a free parameter, a free function that of the laps.
It has some dynamical variables at time t.
Yeah.
So
for example, you say the laps. The harmonic equation, but this one generalized the harmonic equation. They're more general.
But what do you mean by what is the piece? What is the input as you evolve along in time? Besides what the normal variables that are there, when you take the time derivative of the densitized laps. There are trace of k there, for example.
Yeah, but for example, when you take the. I'm going to talk in terms of the laps, where I see the equations. The harmonic gauge is harmonic lapse is alpha dot proportional to k, not proportional, it's minus alpha squared k. That's the harmonic slicing. And the Bonamassa generalizes that to alpha dot equals minus alpha squared f of alpha k. So it's more general.
You don't have to have zero on the harmonic.
No, you don't have to have zero, but you have to have a known function, right?
Yeah.
So in this case, I'm not asking for a known function. It's just a function of the variable of the dynamic variables.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the known function would be.
No,
I don't know the good known function,
because
right?
The large variable is a fine idea, which many people understand.
Yeah. So yeah, that's basically it. So now more generalizations where you have
just
evolution equations for that. The next question is, do we really need hyperbolicity? And I think for a long time we were debating this, and I think that the answer now seems to be that yes, we do need hyperbolicity, because at least strong hyperbolicity is required if you want to have a well-posed system. And if you have an ill-posed system, there's really no hope of having a nice numerical evolution. So that would be the argument. And strong hyperbolicity is the least you want. Symmetric hyperbolicity, if you can achieve it, is even better, because then you can show that it's also well-posed if you have boundary conditions. You know, there's known ways in which you can put consistent boundary conditions for symmetric hyperbolic systems, and for strongly hyperbolic systems, that's not true. Also, if you want to do excision, then at its core, the idea of excision really has hyperbolicity concepts. I mean, you're saying all fields propagate inwards inside the black hole, which is essentially a hyperbolic statement about hyperbolicity of the system. Yeah, then that's it's poorly phrased. It's really the other way around. If it's strongly hyperbolic, you can show it's well posed.
Yeah.
So it's really phrased the wrong way. Yeah. So if it's not strongly hyperbolic, you don't know. It could be, but if it's strongly, you know it's well posed. So
that,
yeah.
Yeah.
But the problem we have now with all these parameters is that it seems that hyperbolicity is not enough. As Lewis was mentioning, hyperbolicity means that you are bounded by exponential growth of the functions, but exponential growth can still be pretty bad numerically. So it doesn't seem to be enough, and we still have to find ways in which we can control the non-principled part terms that seem to be causing trouble now. It's not just the principal part. Now, what I was mentioning about gauge conditions, so this is what I'm talking about, live labs, in which responds dynamically to the evolution instead of just giving up an a priori known function of space-time, which could be a prescribed labs or a prescribed densitized labs. And I was saying, until recently, most hyperbolic reformulations required a prescribed densitized labs, but that's changing now. We have more general slicing conditions at work now.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah. Yes, I would call that a live lab.
So.
Or n equals sine of 3t. I mean, some function. So if it's an a priori known function of space-time, I would call that not live, because it's not responding to what's happening in the simulation. It's something you just thought of from before, which might work. But the thing is, yeah.
Yeah. Every polyation is harmonic
at this point. Exactly. Once you know the source, the gauge force function, then.
Yeah. They're all harmonic.
Yeah.
So the distinction is really very fuzzy. I mean, it doesn't exist.
Actually. Yeah. Yeah, this is just the way in which you calculated the first time.
I wrote this in the paper 10 years ago. I mean, all foliations are harmonic.
Yeah, true. You just need this function.
In a sense,
so what sort of conditions we normally ask for the labs? And those, we have some good ideas. For example, you want to avoid singularities. And this is something that I think is very important, because there's this idea that I think is wrong. People think that when you're using excision, you don't need singularity avoiding slices. But I think people are forgetting that a singularity avoiding slices labs is not only avoiding the physical singularity, it's also avoiding coordinate focus and singularities. And those can easily appear even if you're excising. So you really want some condition in the labs that stops your observers from focusing, even if it's just a coordinate problem. There's other types of coordinate singularities that you want to worry about, for example, what I call gauge shocks. But you also would like a gauge condition that is easy to implement. In that sense, something that's an evolution equation for the lapse is easier than maximal slicing in 3D. Doesn't mean that maximal slicing can't be done. We can do it. But you want something that is easy to implement. And you want something that, when it's coupled to the evolution equations, doesn't destroy the well-postedness you were supposed to want, but keeps the system still being well-posed. So those are things you want to ask. So there's examples, I'm just going to jump to this. There's examples of elliptic gauge conditions or hyperbolic gauge conditions you want to try. For example, this is a generalization of harmonic slicing, where this f is different from 1. If f was 1, it gives you directly harmonic slicing. But there's different things. When you use hyperbolic type slicing conditions, what can happen is what Lewis was mentioning. You can have speeds of propagation of the gauge that are larger than the speed of light, arbitrarily large or small. So that's something to take into account. Also, you have to worry about shift conditions. And this is, I was saying, there's less experience. There's some shift conditions that have been proposed over the years, like the elliptic conditions for minimal distortion. So these conditions have been known for a while. But there's a lot of less experience really trying to use those conditions in 3D. Because they're very, for example, minimal distortion is a coupled system of three elliptic equations, which is very difficult to solve in three dimensions. So there's far less experience with that. So we really don't know what things to ask for the shift. But for example, one thing you would like the shift to do is to control this slice stretching or grid stretching that appears when you have evolutions of black holes and you have a singularity avoiding collapse. The lapse collapses, it keeps going outside, a large gradient develops in the metric, and you would like the shift to try to control that. That's even evolving Schwarzschild. But if you're evolving rotating black holes, then you have dragging of inertial frames, and you want to undo this big shear in the metric by using the shift to bring it back. In principle, you could, yes.
It's elliptic, it's line.
Yeah, you could use. The only problem is it's a complicated system of three equations to solve. So it's difficult. I mean, it can be coded.
Another point that you could raise here is that the densitized lapse is the correct multiplier in the AD and Maxey principle, not the ordinary lapse. Yeah. Various people have noted it, but the significance has been lost in that when you hold it fixed, rather than a lapse function, when you vary the metric, you get the so-called standard ADM equations,
yeah,
which have the equation of motion that the Ricci tensor IJ,
yeah,
is the equation of motion zero. And the old ADM, when you hold the lapse function fixed, you get the Einstein tensor IJ equals zero, which is, yeah, not equivalent and is not correct unless you're on the constrained hypercurrent.
Yeah.
So that old problem is ADM made the guess that the multiplier would be a scalar. The lab, but it isn't. It's a scalar densitized scalar.
Yeah.
So, but the point is very important that the lapse function is now a dynamical variable.
Yeah.
And this messes up a lot of what people think canonical gravity really means. For example, for other applications. So that's a very important touch. I mean.
Yeah.
The correct equation, or the better equation, come when you fix the densitized lapse. That makes the lapse function a dynamical variable.
Yeah. I thought I didn't know.
Yeah, and if you study the final formulation of the initial data problem, the lapse function must participate in the canonical equation in the initial data solution, no matter how you do it, if you do it correctly. And this means, again, the lapse function.
The final.
That's to be part of the dynamical system.
Yeah. That's really nice.
It's a very interesting conclusion.
Yeah. So, the last comment I wanted to make about the shift is you can use the shift to go to a co-rotating system, and I'm going to show you examples of that in a minute. Then boundary conditions. I'm not going to talk about boundary conditions because I'm going to run out of time, but just to mention again that you really need to be careful about boundary conditions, and that's something we should have known long ago, but we've been reminded recently that this is really very important, and you want your boundary conditions to keep the system well-posed. And not only that, but you want them to be consistent with the constraints. You could have a well-posed system of evolution equations with boundaries, but still be feeding in constraint violation from the boundaries. So this is an important problem. Excision, already Lewis mentioned what's the idea of excision. You just cut the interior of the black hole with some surface, and in principle, you don't actually need any boundary conditions here because you can show that if you're sufficiently in the domain of causality of any point of the boundary, well, the past of any point in the boundary, the causal path is actually in the region where you do have data. So in principle, you wouldn't need any boundary conditions to implement this idea. And this is normally the way people always think that we should do black holes in 3D. But it's not necessarily true, because even if your initial data has a singularity, but if you know what the structure of the singularity is, for example, if it's a coordinate singularity because you've compactified another asymptotically flat infinity, then you can basically factor out that analytically and just evolve the regular part of the metric. That's what we now call puncture evolution, but I should mention that this is actually what people had done or did for a long time. This is what Han and Lindquist did already in 64. This is what Smart and Epley did. This is what the Aninos et al. Simulations of the NCSA in the mid-90s did. So they didn't use excision at all, and it worked. So excision is not necessary. It probably will help a lot, but it's not necessary. And sometimes if you can get away without excision, you might get rid of a lot of problems that the excision boundary might introduce. So this is an idea to keep in mind. Now I have the movies to show you. Many of you have seen these movies, so I'll probably just show a couple of these and then the new ones. This is just an old evolution done by the NCSA group of Misner initial data head-on collision. You had the two black holes here, two equal mass black holes head-on collision. The surface you see is the lapse function. The colors you see are essentially a measure of gravitational waves, the psi 4 quantity. The rotation you see is fake, just because whoever decided to do this movie thought it was nice to move the point of view of the observer. But this is what we could do about 10 years ago, a bit less. Two black holes, again, the lapse collapses, the common horizon appears, and you see the gravitational waves coming out. This is the head-on collision. So this examples of the head-on collision, I'll just show you one of these. The one I showed you before was done with an axisymmetric code. This one was done with a 3D code, but it's still the head-on collision. So here you have the green surface is the event horizon. So there was actually an event horizon tracker in this code. And you see the toroidal pattern of gravitational waves. These are old collisions, old movies. More recent results of real 3D configurations, even though the one I showed you was in a 3D code, it was still an axisymmetric configuration. 3D configurations, there is no movie for this one as far as I know, Bernd, right? But this is the Grayson collision that Brugmann did in 97. And you can see this some time after the, I think, T equals 4 or something after the initial data evolution. You had different mass black holes with spins and momenta and unaligned momenta, and they would actually hit each other with a glancing blow. And then you have the inner apparent horizons and the outer apparent horizon that appears after some evolution. This simulation didn't last very, very long, but it was, I think, a proof of principle simulation, really, that, to show that we could start thinking about these things. And it's very recent, if you see, 97. After that, then people started really thinking that they could do this problem and do some much, much more interesting simulations. This is the simulation of the Penn State-Texas collaboration of 3 years ago, 4 years ago. This data actually is courtesy of Deirdre. And this was a different type, again, a Grayson collision, but this one was with excision. So you can see it here, the little holes in the grid is the excised region. And the initial data was also very different. In the previous one, was initial data of the type of Misner or Lindquist, actually puncture initial data, but Greg will mention that. This one was Kerr-Shield type initial data, so very different initial data. This is the simulation done by Potts. I'm sorry, I didn't want to do that yet. This is the Grayson collision done by the Potsen group about the same time as the other Grayson collision. This is puncture data, no excision. The two apparent horizons of the two black holes here is the same initial data as the Grayson collision of Brugmann, but done a couple of years later with much improved understanding. You would be surprised how much we learned in those 2 years. And particularly, we switched formulations from ADM to BSSM. And that made a very big difference. So this is just the evolution of the horizons. And then the other one, you can see the gravitational waves. You see the apparent horizon suddenly appearing. Recently, in the last few weeks, we've learned that this simulation actually is just one black hole because the event horizon was already merged from T equals zero. But that's something we didn't know at the time. It's just very recent. This one shows the pattern of gravitational waves, psi 4. This very nice spiral pattern of waves. And you see all the numerical error towards the end that's really killing the simulation. There was a bug when we did this movie, and you can actually see the processor boundaries because this was a parallel simulation, so you can see them there.
Do you think that the apparent horizon popping out, which is what you're supposed to do, might well just mask the plunge part of the final plunge part of the collision and consume all the gravitational radiation as they inspire, so you don't see anything?
That could be. Yeah, I hope not. But
I think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah. That could be. So the last thing I want to show you is the very recent results. This is, well, I'm not going to show this one, but this is ISCO, results for an ISCO, where we define an ISCO in terms of the Baumgarte, essentially the Baumgarte-Cook approach, even though the Baumgarte and Cook initial data are different, but the difference is very, very small. So we take what's called the innermost stable circular orbit according to that ansatz, and we evolved the system, and we went to co-rotating coordinates. This one just shows you why co-rotating coordinates were important. You see the evolution of the apparent horizons for three different choices of the co-rotation parameter. No co-rotation, too much co-rotation, and just the right co-rotation. And you see what happens to the apparent horizons in our grid. And then once we chose the right co-rotation parameter, this is the full evolution. So you're showing, I'm showing here the apparent horizons. The color map will be the lapse function. And these little dots are just there to show where the centers of the black holes with these punctures were at the beginning, just for reference. There's no excision in this run. And the common horizon appears, and eventually we lose the inner horizons, but the common horizon remains circular. There was a large shift vector in this simulation, which is not shown in this one, but I show it here. So these arrows, you can barely see them, but it's the shift vector, and the color indicates the magnitude of the shift vector. So there's a co-rotating shift vector. It's actually a dynamical shift vector, even though out here it doesn't seem to do much. But in there, if you look carefully, you can see that the arrows are pointing in different directions and moving around. So that's why the black holes don't seem to move. They're actually orbiting each other in the ISCO. Well, they're actually plunging, but they're moving around. And you don't see that because we're using a co-rotating shift. And this is something we call a pre-ISCO, which is further out, as Ron mentioned, from the ISCO. And it's a simulation of about a year ago. You barely see here, but this is the horizon here, and the other horizon is over there. They look more clearly later. And that's Psi-4 again. So this is two black holes separated further apart than the ISCO, according to this ansatz. And then you let them go. And then you can see now that there's the common horizon has appeared. There's a black hole there, and then you see the Psi-4 function. So this is almost state-of-the-art. It's about a year ago, and the Potsdam group's just been repeating these runs in the last few days, I understand, just to get more understanding of what's going on there. 5 minutes. Okay, so I'm almost done. This is something that I really wanted to show, that is very recent results of evolutions of binary black holes in different configurations with different initial data, and there's things we don't understand here. So basically what we're plotting here is the black hole separation in units of the total mass of the system, essentially separation measured from horizon to horizon. And here is the time it takes for the black holes to merge in terms of the time it takes for the common horizon to appear. So we're plotting here several things. For example, this line here would be the Newtonian free-fall time for particles that crash head-on with the same mass as the black hole. And this one here, for reference, is also the time it actually takes for two black holes to collide according to this head-on calculations done a long time ago. So this is essentially head-on for Newtonian and GR. This is what we get for the Cook type data with different gauge parameters. So if you change the gauge, it's obvious that the time it takes for them to coalesce will change because the time you're measuring is a coordinate time. So there's a coordinate dependence there, but we chose there's different parameters, and what you see is that these curves changed a little bit. But the striking thing is they're very similar to these ones, which is worrying, because this thing's supposed to be rotating, where these things are falling head on. So yeah, that's something we're still working on. That's why we haven't actually published these results, because we're working on trying to estimate errors. So, but you can see, for example, from these two things that just changing the lapse parameters makes a difference already. And this line here, finally, is a very interesting line, because this is the expected period of that orbit, according to the data, the initial data we get from Cook and Baumgarte's papers. And you see, it's pretty large. So it shows that all these data sets are not doing an orbit, even less, considerably less than an orbit. But it's worrying because it gets further and further apart from an orbit. So it seems that as we put them more and more further apart, they do less and less of an orbit. I mean, it takes longer for them to coalesce, but that that time is a smaller fraction of the full orbit you would expect, which is something we still don't understand. It would seem that all these data sets are just plunging. They're not in orbital configurations, really. They're just plunging, which is the only explanation we come up with. So that's where things are at the moment. This is a very recent result. And just to finish, I wanted to show this, well, just one of them, that there is this very recent event horizon finder that Peter Diener wrote, and this is data he just lent me. This is a three black hole collision, just for fun. So three black holes, and this is the event horizon, actually, as the black holes evolve. The event horizon is, in fact, calculated backwards in time, but then you just show the picture forward again, right? So this is also very recent, and now this code is going to be used to study this ISCOS and pre-ISCOS to see if we have a black hole there from the very beginning or not. And just to conclude, so simulations of binary black holes have been going on for a long time. The head-on collision is considered essentially solved. Doesn't mean we can do everything, but we sort of know what's happening. But in contrast, 3D black hole collisions are very recent, in the last 10 years or so. And collisions that are actually, even though it was a 3D code, something that was not head-on initial data, was only attempted for the first time in 97. And orbital configurations have only been recently tried. And I put here Caltech Cornell because I've heard that they're also trying already to put black holes in orbits. I don't really know the results. Maybe they can tell us later, but they're also trying that. And I think what we've learned is that long-lived 3D simulations of black holes are extremely difficult to do. They require a good understanding of the initial data, of the evolution equations, which we're still working on, good gauge conditions, both lapse conditions and shift conditions, because you want to stop dragging off inertial frames. You need consistent boundary conditions and understanding of the well posedness of boundary conditions. Then you need to worry about issues of excision, co-rotation, AMR, hopefully. So there's a lot of work to do. But the good news is that a lot of progress has been made on all these fronts by many different groups. So we do hope that we will be able to solve this problem, maybe not soon, but sometime. Thank you.
Pablo.
In the plot that you just showed, the one about that one. So you also evolved the Moudon data?
Yes, I forgot to mention those. So Dennis is really the one that knows about this plot, not me. But yeah, I understand they evolved these 2 points of the Moudon data. And there's two things to mention. They essentially lie on top of the Cook-Baumgartner type data, which is surprising because it's very different initial data. But the other thing that's important to mention is these 2 points are actually inside the Moudon ISCO. The Moudon estimate of an ISCO is about here, right? It would be a point around there. So you can construct initial data for black holes that are closer in, but their construction will tell you that are just beyond the ISCO. And those are those 2 points. Whereas the ISCO of Cook and Baumgartner lies here. The one of Moudon will lie around here.
So you have third data point?
Not yet. We're waiting for that one.
We've got a bunch of questions over here.
Your evolution that you showed with the three black holes with the event horizon?
Yes.
It was very smooth. What happened to the black holes? Did they interact, or was that just a... What actually happened dynamically to those black holes? Did they plunge together?
As far as I understand, it's just Misner type initial data. So it's three black holes initially sitting there at rest, and then you just let them go, and they attract each other.
So there was no... I expected to see oscillations. I didn't see any...
there were oscillations.
Oscillations
of
the event
horizon. You don't actually see much, but I think if you...
It was very smooth. It was surprisingly smooth.
No, I think
that's my question, really. Does it evolve?
It's an evolution, yeah.
A lot of the oscillations
in the field. No, it is an evolution. He just puts those three there and evolves them with our Poisson code and then backwards track the event horizon.
Well, we have this picture of a distorted black hole forming and ringing down, and this isn't in my head as what that looks like.
Yeah, but I think it's probably small. So if you mapped the curvature or something in color, you would probably see the oscillations clearly. But if you just look at the raw shape, you would notice it's probably very small. But I'm sure it's there, those oscillations.
On that
So are there 3D codes today that can follow two black holes for a whole period?
No.
No, we're not there yet.
That's normal. I think the best that the Potsdam group has done, depending on it, is about half an orbit for this sort of orbital configurations. But it's ambiguous because, as I was saying, the period is half an orbit estimated from the period that you estimate from the initial data. But from this plot, you see that the period is probably way off the real mark, so then the estimation of the orbit is difficult, and we're going to co-rotating coordinates, so then they're not moving. So, and what we find is that the period of the we need to put in the co-rotating coordinates is about half, or the actual angular velocity is about half the one that you would expect from the initial data. So if you use that angular velocity to make the estimate instead of the one you get from the initial data, we're only doing about a quarter of an orbit. And that's the best we can do.
On your plot of all your collision times and so on, the previous plot, your black hole separation on the horizontal axis, is that in what slicing is that, and are they all the same gauge?
It's
for
from
all
the initial. There's a black hole separation of the initial data, and it's just measured horizon to horizon along a straight line in
along
coordinate space.
In coordinate space.
So you take your coordinate space and you define a straight line there, which is not going to be a geodesic, but okay. You locate your apparent horizons, those are the true apparent horizons, and then you just measure the
okay.
distance.
Okay, so that's can, the distance. Do you know how much of, so how much should I believe that, and, you know, cause, since, you know, these initial data might be in, you know, using different slicings and so
yeah,
on.
That's they're on maximal slices.
They're all maximal
initial
slices.
Data is on maximal, the Medon data is
okay.
also on maximal slices. Yeah, they're all on maximal slices.
The whole family,
exactly.
Right.
So it's
right.
just what you get from that initial data. So. Yeah.
Okay.
So Mark Miller has been looking at the, well, actually Mark can describe what he has been doing much better than I, but the eccentricity of the orbits of a binary neutron star collision and trying to see whether you can get some sensible thing for that. And I think what he finds is that because of lack of resolution and the boundaries being too close in some sense, apparently you cannot get a good result in the sense that you double the position of the, or double the size of the computational domain, and this thing changes a lot. And so my question is, could it happen that here you have something like that in the sense that this time to coalescence that you're computing is, depends a lot
on the boundaries
and on the lack of resolution as well? I mean, have you done conversion tests in resolution and in the size of the computational domain to see how much of these points, so this is related to what Luis said, you have these points here, but do you know what the error bars are if you change resolution or change the size of the computational domain? That it could well be that the size of the error bars hits the upper line and you have no contradiction.
The boundaries, I don't know if you tried putting them with different equations.
Ah, okay, so we have done that already.
I see. Yeah, they don't seem to be affected too much, and they're way too early.
Other questions? All right, let's thank Miguel and Frank for today's speaker.